profoundly grateful to have her calm and loving companionship. Perhaps to divert my feelings in the long hours I spent in the hospital, I talked with doctors, nurses, pharmacists, hospital administrators, and family members of other patients about the present healthcare system. One of the doctors told me how frustrating it was for him to write prescriptions for some Medicare patients knowing that they could not afford to fill them. Other patients paid for their drugs but took smaller doses than prescribed to make them last longer. Often these patients ended up right back in the hospital. The healthcare policy problems we were tackling in Washington were now a part of my daily reality. Bill returned to Little Rock on Sunday, March 28, and we gathered our immediate family together and met with the doctors, who spelled out our options. Hugh Rodham was essentially brain dead, kept alive by machines. None of us could imagine that the fiercely independent man we had known would want us to keep his body alive under such circumstances. Each member of the family agreed that we should remove him from the respirator that night, after our final goodbyes, and let God take him home. Dr. Kampouras told us he would probably die within 24 hours. However, the soul of the former Nittany Lions football player and boxer wasn't quite ready to leave. After the life support was removed, Dad began to breathe on his own, and his heart kept on beating. Bill stayed with us until Tuesday, when he had to resume his schedule. On Wednesday, April 7th, my father died. I couldn't help but think how my relationship with my father had evolved over time. I adored him when I was a little girl. I tried to bring home good grades to win his approval. But as I grew older, my relationship with him inevitably changed, partly because he changed. He gradually lost the energy that got him outside throwing football pass patterns to me and Hugh as we ran around the elm trees in front of our house. More and more, his immediate world seemed to shrink as he lost his father and both brothers in a few short years in the mid-60s. During my high school and college years, our relationship increasingly was defined either by silence as I searched for something to say to him, or by arguments, which I often provoked because I knew he would always engage with me over politics and culture, Vietnam, hippies, bra-burning feminists, Nixon. I also understood that even when he erupted at me, he admired my independence and accomplishments and loved me with all his heart. I also respected my father's willingness to change his views, although he would rarely admit he had. He started out in life inheriting every prejudice imaginable in his working-class Protestant family, against Democrats, Catholics, Jews, and blacks, and anyone else considered outside the tribe. When I got exasperated by these attitudes during our summer visits to Lake Winola, I denounced to all the Rodhams that I intended to grow up and marry a Catholic Democrat, a fate they considered the worst I could meet. Over time, my father softened and changed, largely because of personal experiences with all kinds of people. When I grew up and fell in love with a Southern Baptist Democrat, my father was bewildered, but he rallied and became one of Bill's strongest supporters. When my parents moved to Little Rock in 1987, they bought a condo next to the one owned by Larry Curbo, a nurse, and Dr. Dillard Denson, a neurologist. One night, my parents were watching a television show that featured gay characters. When my father expressed his disapproval of homosexuals, my mother said, "What about Dillard and Larry?" "What do you mean?" he asked. So my mother explained to my father that his dear friends and neighbors were a gay couple in a long-lasting, committed relationship. One of my father's last stereotypes fell. Larry and Dillard visited my father in the hospital as he lay in a coma. One night, Larry relieved my mother for a few hours so she could go home and get some rest, and it was Larry who held my father's hand and said goodbye as he died. We laid him to rest in the Washburn Street Cemetery. It was a cold, rain-drenched April day, and my thoughts were as gloomy as the leaden sky. I stood listening to the military honor guard's bugler playing taps. Chelsea reminded us that her pop-pop had always said that when she graduated from college, he would rent a big limousine and pick her up wearing a white suit. He had many dreams that wouldn't be realized, but I was thankful for the life, opportunities, and dreams he passed along to me. Bill, Chelsea, and I wanted to spend Easter at Camp David, and we invited our immediate family and the friends who had come to Scranton. That Easter weekend was cold and rainy, and it fit my mood perfectly. I went for a long walk in the drizzle with my mother, and I asked her if she wanted to live with us in the White House. In her characteristically independent manner, she said she would stay a while, but she wanted to go home to attend to all the issues accompanying my father's death. She thanked me for inviting Dillard Denson and Larry Kerbo to Camp David. She knew they would continue to be valuable friends as she faced her life alone. After sharing Easter dinner together with our guests, Bill, Chelsea, and I returned to Washington. I didn't get much sleep that night, and it was a particularly short one. Starting at about 5 a.m., parents and children were lining up outside the gates for the annual Easter egg roll that takes place on the South Lawn Easter Monday. When I looked out the window at around 8 a.m., I saw thousands of children gathered, spoons in hand, waiting to push brightly colored Easter eggs across the grass. They were thrilled to be there, and there was no way I would let my personal concerns ruin their day. So I got dressed and stepped out into the sun. At first, I was going through the motions. Then the children's excitement and laughter rippling across the wide green lawn touched my heart and lifted my spirits. As the administration neared its 100-day mark at the end of April, it was obvious that we would not meet our self-imposed deadline for a health care package. The nation was still reeling from the ghastly outcome of the standoff in Waco, Texas. In the former Yugoslavia, Bosnian Serbs were besieging the Muslim town of Srebrenica in a frenzy of ethnic cleansing, and I was disgusted by the failure of the United Nations to intervene or even protect a Muslim population. In the shadow of these events, Bill and I hosted 12 presidents and prime ministers at the White House who had come to Washington for the dedication of the Holocaust Museum on April 22nd. Some of the visiting leaders were pressuring the United States to get more involved in the UN effort to stop the slaughter in Bosnia. The most eloquent messenger of this viewpoint was Elie Wiesel, who delivered an impassioned speech about Bosnia at the museum dedication. Wiesel, a Nazi death camp survivor and winner of the Nobel Peace Prize, turned to Bill and said, "Mr. President, I have been in the former Yugoslavia. I cannot sleep since what I have seen. As a Jew, I am saying that. We must do something to stop the bloodshed in that country." Sitting in the gray drizzle, I agreed with Ellie's words, because I was convinced that the only way to stop the genocide in Bosnia was through selective airstrikes against Serbian targets. With so much going on, some of the administration's best moments were eclipsed. To commemorate Earth Day, April 22nd, Bill pledged to sign an important international biodiversity treaty that President Bush had rejected. The following week, he announced a national service program, AmeriCorps, that would revive the idealism of the Peace Corps and VISTA and direct the energy of young volunteers to tackle the needs of our own country. Whatever our public demands, Bill and I tried never to lose sight of our obligations as Chelsea's parents. We went to every school event and stayed up with her while she finished her homework. Bill could still help with her eighth grade algebra, and if he was traveling out of town, she would fax him her problems, and then they would talk over solutions. Meanwhile, I was still learning the ropes and still discovering what it meant to be America's First Lady. I was taking one of my first solo trips as First Lady when a young aide asked me, "What would you like to drink in your suite?" "You know, I really feel like a Diet Dr. Pepper," I said. For years afterward, every time I opened a refrigerator in a hotel suite, it was loaded with Diet Dr. Pepper. People would come up to me with frosty glasses of it. I felt like the Sorcerer's Apprentice, the Mickey Mouse character in the classic animated film Fantasia. I couldn't turn off the Dr. Pepper machine. I had to recognize how many people wanted to do whatever they could to please me, and how seriously they might misinterpret what I wanted. Maybe I should have figured that out earlier, but I didn't, until I was stuck with the consequences of an offhand comment I made after hearing about concerns of financial mismanagement and waste in the White House travel office. I said to Chief of Staff Mac McLarty that if there were such problems, I hoped he would, quote, look into it. Travelgate, as it came to be known in the media, was perhaps worthy of a 2 or 3 week lifespan. Instead, in a partisan political climate, it became the first manifestation of an obsession for investigation that persisted into the next millennium. Before we moved into the White House, Neither Bill nor I nor our immediate staff had known that there was a White House travel office. The travel office charters planes, books hotel rooms, orders meals, and generally takes care of the press when they travel with the president. An audit had discovered that the director of the travel office kept an off-book ledger, that a minimum of $18,000 of checks had not been properly accounted for, and that the office's records were in shambles. Based on these findings, Mack and the White House counsel's office decided to fire the travel office staff and reorganize the department. These actions, which seemed like no-brainers to the decision-makers involved, ignited a firestorm. At least seven separate investigations, including those conducted by the White House, the General Accounting Office, the FBI, and Kenneth Starr's Office of the Independent Counsel, failed to turn up any illegality, wrongdoing, or conflicts of interest by anyone in the administration, and confirmed that the initial concerns about the travel office were justified. Vince Foster was stung by the travel office affair. A meticulous, decent, and honorable man, he felt that he had let down the president and me by failing to understand and contain the drama. Apparently, the final blow came in a series of spiteful editorials published in the Wall Street Journal, which attacked the integrity and competence of all the Arkansas lawyers in the Clinton administration. On June 17, 1993, an editorial titled, "Who is Vince Foster?" proclaimed that the most disturbing thing about the administration was its carelessness about following the law. Bill and I may have been inexperienced in our White House roles, but we were seasoned enough in the rough world of politics. We knew we had to isolate the attacks and focus on the reality of our lives. Vince Foster had no such defenses. Although we will never know what went through his mind in those last weeks of his life, I believe that as he absorbed each accusation, he was driven deeper into pain and distress. I will go to my own grave, wishing I had spent more time with him and had somehow seen the signs of his despair. After the annual G7 summit in Tokyo in early July, my mother and I met Chelsea in Hawaii, where I attended a meeting on Hawaii's statewide healthcare system. On July 20th, Chelsea and I flew to Arkansas to drop off my mother and to visit some friends. That night, sometime between 8 and 9 o'clock, Mack McLarty called me at my mother's house and told me he had terrible news. Vince Foster was dead. It looked like a suicide. I was so staggered that I still can't sort out the sequence of events that night. I remember crying and questioning Mack. I just couldn't believe it. Was he sure there wasn't a mistake? Mack gave me some sketchy details about the body discovered in a park, the handgun at the scene, a gunshot wound in the head. He wanted my advice about when to tell the president. At that moment, Bill was appearing on CNN's Larry King Live from the White House and had just agreed to go into an extra half hour. Mack asked me if I thought Bill should finish the show. I thought Mack should cut the interview short so he could tell Bill as soon as possible. I couldn't bear the idea of Bill being told on live TV about the tragic death of one of his closest friends. As soon as Mack got off the line, I told my mother and Chelsea. Then I started dialing everyone I could think of who knew Vince, hoping someone could shed light on how and why this could have happened. I craved information like oxygen. I was frantic because I felt so far away, and I couldn't figure out what was going on. As soon as Bill finished the show, I called him. He sounded shell-shocked and kept saying, "How could this have happened? And I should have stopped it somehow." Vince's funeral service was held in Little Rock's St. Andrew's Cathedral. After the service, we drove in a long, mournful caravan to Hope, where Vince was born and raised. It was a blazing summer day and heat rose in waves over the dusty fields. Vince was buried just outside of town. By then, I was beyond words. Numb. All I could feel was a vague notion that Vince was finally safe now, back home where he belonged. Soon a cottage industry of conspiracy theorists and investigators were trying to prove that Vince was murdered to cover up what he knew about Whitewater. Those rumors should have ended with the official report ruling his death a suicide, and with the sheet of notepaper found torn into 27 pieces at the bottom of Vince's briefcase. It was not so much a suicide note as a cry from the heart, an accounting of the things that were tearing at his soul. I was not meant for the job in the spotlight of public life in Washington. Here, ruining people is considered sport, he wrote. The public will never believe the innocence of the Clintons and their loyal staff. The Wall Street Journal editors lie without consequence. Those words left me grief-stricken. His short time in public service destroyed his self-image, and in his mind, irreparably stained his reputation. The 6 months since the exuberance of Inauguration Day had been brutal. My father and close friend dead, Vince's wife, children, family, and friends devastated, my mother-in-law dying, the faltering missteps of a new administration being literally turned into federal cases. I was on automatic pilot, pushing myself to attend healthcare meetings on the Hill and deliver speeches, often on the verge of weeping. If I met someone who reminded me of my father, or I ran across a nasty comment about Vince, I would feel the tears well up in my eyes. This was one of the times when I kept going on sheer willpower. By the middle of August, we were so wrapped up in work that Bill and I both nearly had to be bound, gagged, and tossed onto the plane for our vacation on Martha's Vineyard. It turned out to be a wonderful and healing time for me. It was Anne and Vernon Jordan who persuaded us to come to the vineyard, where they had been vacationing for years. I slept and swam and felt the months of tension beginning to melt away. The Jordans' party to celebrate Bill's 47th birthday on August 19th was filled with old friends and new people who made me laugh and relax. It was one of the best times I'd had since the inauguration. Jackie Kennedy Onassis was there with her longtime companion, Maurice Templesman. The always gracious Catherine Graham, publisher of the Washington Post, came, as did Bill and Rose Styron. Styron had recently published Darkness Visible, a memoir of madness, recounting his struggles with clinical depression. I talked to him about Vince at dinner, and we continued the conversation the next day, during a long walk on one of the vineyard's beautiful beaches. He described the overwhelming sense of loss and desperation that can grip a person until the desire for release from the daily pain and disorientation makes death seem a preferable, even rational choice. I also spent time with Jackie. Her house, surrounded by several hundred of the most beautiful acres on Martha's Vineyard, had books and flowers everywhere, and windows looking out over the gentle dunes leading to the ocean in the distance. The house had the same unpretentious elegance that characterized everything Jackie did. I loved seeing her and Maurice together. Charming, smart, and well-read, he radiated love, respect, and concern for her, as well as delight in her company. They made each other laugh, one of my criteria for any relationship. Jackie and Maurice invited us to go sailing on Maurice's yacht with Caroline Kennedy Schlossberg and her husband, Ed Schlossberg, Ted and Vicky Kennedy, and Anne and Vernon Jordan. Caroline is one of the few people in the world who can understand Chelsea's unique experiences, and from that visit onward, she became a perceptive friend and role model for my daughter. Ted Kennedy, Caroline's uncle, and the paterfamilias of the Kennedy clan, is one of the most effective senators who has ever served our country, and is also an expert sailor. He kept up a running commentary about pirates and naval battles. We motored out of Menemsha Harbor on a glorious sunny day, and anchored next to a small island to go swimming before lunch. I went below to put on my bathing suit, and by the time I came back up on the deck, Jackie, Ted, and Bill were already in the water. Caroline and Chelsea had climbed up to a platform about 40 feet above the water. As I looked up, they jumped together and landed in the ocean with a splash. They came up laughing and swam back to the boat for another jump. Chelsea said, "Come on, Mom, try it." Of course, Ted and Bill started yelling, "Yeah, give it a try, give it a try." For reasons that escape me to this day, I said, "Okay." I'm not all that athletic anymore. But the next thing I knew, I was following Caroline and Chelsea up a narrow little ladder to get to the top. By now I was thinking, how did I get myself into this? As soon as Caroline and Chelsea reached the platform, boom, off they went again. Now, perched up there alone, looking down at the tiny figures below me treading water, I listened to their shouts, "Come on, come on, jump!" Then I heard Jackie's voice rising above the rest, "Don't do it, Hillary! Don't let them talk you into it! Don't do it!" I thought to myself, now there is the voice of reason and experience. She knew exactly what was going through my mind, and she came to my rescue. "You know you're right," I shouted back. Slowly I climbed down with as much dignity as I could summon. Then I got into the water and went for a swim with my friend Jackie. When we returned to Washington a week before Labor Day, it was time for the White House to focus full-time on the health care initiative, or so I hoped. But by late August, Treasury Secretary Lloyd Bentsen, Secretary of State Warren Christopher, and Economic Advisor Bob Rubin were adamant about postponing health care reform and moving forward with the North American Free Trade Agreement known as NAFTA. It was Bill's decision, and he concluded that NAFTA had to be addressed first. Once again, health care would have to wait. By early September, Bill was also focused on preparations for the upcoming visit of Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin and Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat, and the signing of a new Middle East peace accord. The historic meeting that took place on the White House South Lawn on September 13, 1993, was the result of months of negotiations in Oslo, Norway. I had first met Yitzhak and Leah Rabin earlier that spring when they paid a courtesy call at the White House. Both Yitzhak and Leah were realistic about the challenges that lay ahead for Israel. They believed they had no choice but to try to achieve a secure future for their nation through negotiations with their sworn enemies. On that auspicious day, Bill persuaded Yitzhak to shake hands with Arafat as a tangible sign of their commitment to the peace plan. Rabin agreed, as long as there would be no kissing, a common Arab custom. Before the ceremony, Bill and Yitzhak engaged in a hilarious rehearsal of the handshake, with Bill pretending to be Arafat as they practiced a complicated maneuver that would prevent the Palestinian leader from drawing too close. Even as he worked on these varied and pressing issues, Bill scheduled a televised primetime address to Congress on September 22nd to outline the health care plan. Bill gave a great speech, with just the right mix of passion, wisdom, and substance. He held up a red, white, and blue health security card that he hoped would be issued to every American, vowing to deliver a plan that would guarantee every citizen health insurance coverage and access to affordable, quality medical care. After the speech, we loaded up the motorcade and headed back to the White House. We decided to go first to the old executive office building, where the healthcare staff worked in crowded makeshift cubicles in room 160. Bill and I thanked them for spending days and nights working for reform. I stood on a chair and declared to laughter and applause that with the impending birth of the healthcare bill, the room would now be renamed the delivery room. But any presidential agenda is subject to outside events. Bill was en route to California on October 3rd. When his aides received an urgent call from the White House Situation Room. Two Black Hawk helicopters had been shot down in Somalia. The news got worse. The body of an American serviceman had been dragged through the streets of Mogadishu. Bill was given terrible news about Russia, too. There had been an attempted military coup against President Boris Yeltsin. On October 5th in Culver City, California, Bill cut short a town hall meeting about health care and returned to Washington. Over the next few weeks, Bill, the news media, and the nation were consumed by Somalia and the unrest in Russia, and healthcare reform took a back seat. Giving Congress a comprehensive bill at the outset turned out to be a tremendous challenge and a tactical mistake. We thought it would be 250 pages at most, but as drafting continued, it became clear that the bill needed to be much longer, in part because the plan was complex. The Health Security Act, delivered by the White House to Congress on October 27th, was 1,342 pages long. A few weeks later, on the last day of the congressional session, and with little fanfare, Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell introduced the measure. With so much happening, I could have easily forgotten my own birthday on October 26th, but my staff never missed an occasion for a party. All the lights inside the residence were off. A power blackout, I was told. That was my first clue. The power never goes off in the White House. I was ushered upstairs and told to put on a black wig and hoop skirt, the colonial look to be sure, and an attempt to replicate the fashions worn by Dolly Madison. Then I was led down to the state floor, where I was greeted by a dozen staffers in blonde wigs representing a dozen different Hillaries. Headband Hillary, cookie baking Hillary, healthcare Hillary. Bill was disguised as President James Madison with white wig and tights. I loved him for it, but I was glad we were living in the late 20th century He looks better in a suit. On Halloween 1993, I picked up a copy of the Sunday Washington Post and learned that our old, money-losing real estate venture in Arkansas had come back to haunt us. Because of our past connection with McDougal, we were wrongly implicated in his subsequent misadventures. During the 1992 presidential race, allegations surfaced in the press and were quickly dismissed that McDougal had received special favors from the state when Bill was governor because of his business relationship with us. The story faded when Bill and I proved that we had lost money on the Whitewater investment and that while he was governor, the Arkansas Securities Department had actually urged the federal regulators to remove McDougal and shut down his savings and loan, Madison Guarantee. Bill and I failed to recognize the political significance of Whitewater's sudden reappearance. The name Whitewater came to represent a limitless investigation of our lives that cost the taxpayers over $70 million for the independent counsel investigations alone and never turned up any wrongdoing on our part. Bill and I voluntarily cooperated with investigators. Every time they leaked or leveled a new charge, we bent over backwards to make sure we hadn't missed or overlooked anything substantive. But as one allegation followed another, we realized we were chasing ghosts in a house of mirrors. We would run in one direction only to have the apparition pop up behind us. Whitewater never seemed real because it wasn't. The purpose of the investigations was to discredit the president and the administration and slow down its momentum. Whitewater was a political war from the start, and it raged throughout Bill Clinton's presidency. It didn't matter what the investigations were about. It only mattered that there were investigations. It didn't matter that we had done nothing wrong. It only mattered that our lives and the work of the president were disrupted over and over again. Whitewater became a convenient catch-all for any and all attacks that our political adversaries could design. Our personal lawyer, Bob Barnett, recused himself from Whitewater because his wife, Rita Braver, was a CBS correspondent assigned to cover the White House. Bob recommended David Kendall, his colleague at Williams & Connolly, to represent us in the Whitewater matter. We had known David for years. Although he was a few years older than Bill and me, we had overlapped at Yale Law School. Like Bill, David was a Rhodes Scholar. As a fellow Midwesterner, David was born and raised in rural Indiana on a farm. He and I had a natural rapport. Soon he became an anchor in our lives. David met with us in the White House every week or so for the next 3 months. As I listened with fascination, he filled us in on what he had learned while piecing together gaps in the Whitewater record and tracing Jim McDougal's increasingly bizarre investments. Trying to recreate McDougal's paper trail, he said, was like shoveling smoke. Even before the Justice Department issued a subpoena, we agreed through David to cooperate fully and without delay. After spending the Thanksgiving holiday at Camp David, we came back a few pounds heavier, but refreshed. I was particularly pleased that Bill signed the Brady Bill on November 30, 1993. Long overdue, it was common sense legislation to require a 5-day waiting period to check the background of any purchaser of a handgun. NAFTA was ratified on December 8, 1993. Which meant the administration could finally turn its full attention to supporting health care reform. To keep up the momentum, I had taken to the road with Dr. C. Everett Koop, who had been President Reagan's Surgeon General and who had become an increasingly enthusiastic advocate of our health care plan. Back in Washington, the White House Christmas season rituals were in full swing. Christmas is always a big event in the Clinton family. Bill and Chelsea are enthusiastic shoppers, gift wrappers, and tree decorators. I love watching them trim our tree together, pausing to reminisce about the origin of each ornament. This year was no different, although it took a while to find the family Christmas decorations. Many of our possessions remained in unlabeled boxes stuffed in rooms on the third floor of the White House or in the presidential warehouse in Maryland. Finally, though, our treasured Christmas stockings hung from the mantel of the fireplace in the yellow oval room, in a house that was starting to feel like home. This would be the last Christmas for Virginia, who was getting weaker and required regular transfusions. She insisted that she couldn't remain through New Year's because she and Dick were going to Barbra Streisand's concert in Las Vegas. I think Virginia willed herself to live long enough to make the trip because there was nothing she enjoyed more than a swing through the casinos and a chance to see Barbra Streisand perform. The media fixation with Whitewater continued throughout the holiday season. Vince Foster was being hounded beyond the grave. A week before Christmas, the press reported that some of his files, including Whitewater documents, had been, quote, spirited out of his office by Bernie Nussbaum, the White House counsel. Then we were confronted with an outrageous partisan attack. On Saturday, December 18th, I was hosting a holiday reception when David Kendall reached me by telephone. "Hillary," he said, "I've got to tell you about something very, very ugly." I sat down and listened as David summarized a long, detailed article that would appear in the American Spectator, a right-wing monthly that regularly attacked the administration. The article, written by David Brock, was filled with the most vile stories I had ever heard, worse than the salacious garbage in supermarket tabloids. Brock's main sources were four Arkansas troopers from Bill's former bodyguard detail. They claimed, among other things, that they had procured women for Bill when he was governor. My first thoughts were for Chelsea and for my mother and Virginia, who had already been through too much. "What can we do about it?" I asked David. "Is there anything anyone can do?" His advice was to stay calm and say nothing. I soon realized that attacks on our reputations could jeopardize the work Bill was doing to set the country on a different track. Although the initial damage had been done, the media finally started examining the troopers' motives. It turned out that two were angry because they felt that Bill had been ungrateful to them. Another trooper, who reportedly claimed that Bill had offered him a federal job for his silence, later signed an affidavit swearing it never happened. But nearly a decade would pass before we learned the full, chilling story behind what became known as Troopergate. David Brock, the author of the Spectator article, was seized by an attack of conscience, and in 1998 publicly apologized to Bill and me for the lies he had spread about us. Among Brock's secret patrons was the Chicago financier Peter Smith, a key supporter of Newt Gingrich. According to Brock, the success of the Trooper article inspired Richard Mellon Scaife, an ultra-conservative billionaire from Pittsburgh, to fund similar stories through a clandestine enterprise called the Arkansas Project. Along with other members of Scaife's secret Arkansas Project, Brock took on the task of planting and nourishing seeds of doubt about Bill Clinton's character and his fitness to govern. One frosty morning between Christmas and New Year's, Maggie Williams and I were having coffee in our favorite spot in the residence, the West Sitting Hall, in front of the large, fan-shaped window. We were talking and leafing through the newspapers. Most front pages were wall-to-wall Whitewater. "Hey, look at this," said Maggie, as she handed me a copy of USA Today. "It says you and the president are the most admired people in the world." I didn't know whether to laugh or cry. All I could do was hope that the American people would maintain their reserves of fairness and goodwill as I struggled to maintain my own. The sound of a telephone ringing in the middle of the night is one of the most jarring in the world. When our bedroom phone rang long after midnight on January 6, 1994, it was Dick Kelly calling to tell Bill that his mother had just died in her sleep at her home in Hot Springs. There wasn't a church in Hot Springs big enough to accommodate a lifetime's worth of Virginia's friends. The memorial service would have to be held at the convention center in downtown Hot Springs. Bill told me, "If the weather were better, we could have used Oak Lawn Racetrack. Mother would have loved that." I smiled at the thought of the track filled with thousands of racing fans cheering one of their own. After the service, we drove to the cemetery in Hope, where Virginia would be laid to rest with her parents and first husband, Bill Blythe. Air Force One picked us up at the airport in Hope for the sad flight back to Washington. The plane was filled with family and friends who tried to lift Bill's spirits. But even on the day he buried his mother, Bill couldn't escape being hounded about Whitewater. White House staff members and lawyers huddled with the president. Everyone was concerned that the drumbeat for appointing a special prosecutor was drowning out Bill's message. I had planned to join Bill in Moscow for the state visit on January 13th. I knew a decision about the special prosecutor had to be made before we left. My gut instinct as a lawyer and a veteran of the Watergate impeachment inquiry staff was to cooperate fully with any legitimate criminal inquiry, but to resist giving someone free rein to probe indiscriminately and indefinitely. The president's political advisors predicted that a special prosecutor would eventually be forced on us and argued that it was better to appoint one and get it over with. I couldn't change their minds. On Tuesday evening, January 11th, I arranged a conference call with Bill in Prague. David Kendall and I met in the Oval Office with a handful of Bill's top aides for a final debate on the issue. Bill was terribly hoarse, and we had to lean into the black, batwing-shaped conference phone to hear his voice. "I don't know how much longer I can take this," he said, frustrated that the press didn't want to talk about the historic expansion of NATO that would soon open the door to the former Warsaw Pact nations. "All they want to know is why we're ducking an independent investigation. I think we've just got to do it," he said. "We've got nothing to hide, and if this keeps up, it's going to drown out our agenda." It was time to fold my cards. "I know that we've got to move past this," I said, "but it's up to you." As others left the room, I picked up the phone to talk to Bill alone. "Why don't you sleep on the decision?" I said. "If you're still willing to do it, we'll send a request to the Attorney General in the morning." "No," he said, "let's get this over with." Though it was late, Bernie Nussbaum began to compose a letter to Janet Reno, relaying the president's formal request that the Attorney General appoint a special prosecutor to conduct an independent investigation of Whitewater. After Chelsea and I arrived in Russia to join Bill, I finally caught up with him that evening. The Yeltsins hosted a state dinner that began with a receiving line in the newly refurbished St. Vladimir Hall and continued with dinner in the Hall of Facets, a many-mirrored room and one of the most beautiful I've seen anywhere in the world. I sat next to President Yeltsin, with whom I'd never had an extended visit, and he kept up a running commentary about the food and wine, informing me in all seriousness that red wine protected Russian sailors on nuclear-powered submarines from the ill effects of strontium 90. I always did like red wine. The next morning, as our long motorcade left the Kremlin, Chelsea and Capricia Marshall were somehow left behind, standing on the steps with Chelsea's lone Secret Service agent and one of Bill's valets. They realized what was happening as they watched the last car pull out, and two men rolled up the red carpet. The agent and Capricia spotted a beat-up white van and raced over to it, determined to commandeer it. The driver, who was delivering sheets, spoke English. Once he understood their story, he loaded the four of them into the back of his van for a mad dash through the barricades to the airport. They made it, only to be refused entrance. The Russian security recognized Chelsea, but they couldn't figure out why she was not with us inside. While they were trying to sort out the confusion, Chelsea and her party picked up their bags and ran toward the terminal. I didn't discover that Chelsea was missing until we were ready to board the plane and they came panting into the terminal. It seems funny now, but at the time I was beside myself worrying. I resolved not to let Chelsea or Capricia out of my sight for the rest of the trip. On January 20th, 1994, the administration's one-year anniversary, Janet Reno announced the appointment of Robert Fisk as special prosecutor. A Republican, Fisk was highly regarded as a thorough and fair-minded lawyer with prosecutorial experience. As expected, the appointment of a special prosecutor quieted the Whitewater uproar for a few days. But just as predictably, a spate of new accusations and rumors filled the scandal vacuum. Newt Gingrich and Republican Senator Al D'Amato of New York clamored for banking committee hearings in both the House and the Senate to probe Whitewater allegations. Robert Fisk managed to forestall the hearings, warning the combative Republicans that they risked interfering with his investigation. He was moving quickly, as promised, slapping subpoenas on witnesses and hauling them before grand juries in Washington and Little Rock. There were mornings in the spring of 1994 when I woke up aching for all the close friends, associates, and relatives who had passed out of our lives or had been unfairly attacked. My father, Virginia, Vince. Then in mid-March, Webb Hubbell suddenly resigned from the Justice Department. Newspaper articles reported that the Rose firm planned to file a complaint against him with the Arkansas Bar Association for questionable billing practices, including overcharging clients and padding his expenses. The allegations were serious enough for him to step down. David Kendall was becoming my main link to the outside world, and he was a godsend. From the very beginning, he advised me not to read newspaper articles and not to watch television reports about the investigation or any of the related scandals. "That's my job," he said. "One of the reasons you hire lawyers is to have them worry for you." As more of our financial records were released or found their way into the press, they generated additional stories. In mid-March, the New York Times ran a front-page article headlined "Top Arkansas Lawyer Helped Hillary Clinton Turn Big Profit." The story accurately reported the profits I had made in the commodities market in 1979, but it falsely implied that our close friend Jim Blair had somehow engineered my windfall in order to gain influence with Bill Clinton on behalf of his client, Tyson Foods. Could I have done it without Jim? No. Did I have to pay my broker over $18,000 in brokerage fees on my trading? Yes. Did my commodity trading influence Bill's decisions as governor? Absolutely not. I now realize that the constant accusations had taken their toll on my relations with the press. By the end of April 1994, I felt confident enough in David Kendall's research and in my understanding of Whitewater and the surrounding issues that I was ready to offer the media what they wanted. Me. I called my chief of staff and said, "Maggie, I want to do it. Let's call a press conference." On the morning of April 22nd, the White House announced that the First Lady would take questions that afternoon in the state dining room. We hoped that a change of scenery would encourage a fresh approach from the media. I didn't calculate what I would wear to this event. My choice of clothes is almost always a last-minute decision. I felt like wearing a black skirt and a pink sweater set. A few reporters immediately interpreted it as an attempt to soften my image, and my 68-minute encounter with the Fourth Estate would go down in history as the pink press conference. One after another, the reporters asked me everything they could think of about Whitewater, and I answered them until they ran out of different ways to ask the same questions. After the press conference, David and I had a drink together in the West Sitting Hall as the sun set beyond the window. As we assessed the day's events, I commented, "You know they're not going to let up. They're just going to keep on coming at us, no matter what we do. We really don't have any good choices here." One of the women in the American Spectator article had taken issue with her portrayal by the Arkansas troopers. Although she was identified in the story only as Paula, she claimed her friends and family recognized her as the woman who supposedly met with Bill in a Little Rock hotel suite during a convention, and later told a trooper she wanted to be the governor's regular girlfriend. At a February convention of the Conservative Political Action Committee, Paula Corbin Jones held a press conference and appeared to identify herself as the Paula in the article. She said she wanted to clear her name, but instead of announcing a libel suit against the Spectator, she accused Bill of sexually harassing her by making unwanted advances. We expected this story to die like the other phony scandals. But on May 6, 1994, 2 days before the statute of limitations ran out, Paula Jones filed a civil suit against the President of the United States, asking for $700,000 in damages. Someone was raising the stakes in this game. It had moved from the tabloids to the courts. By March 1994, Bill and I were discovering that some opposition to health care reform, like Whitewater, was part of a political war that was bigger than Bill or the issues we championed. I worked hard to keep the pro-reform forces together, under the umbrella of the Health Care Reform Project, but we could raise only about $15 million to run a public information campaign and to recruit speakers to fan out across the country. We were thoroughly outspent by our heavyweight corporate opponents, who, according to estimates, infused at least $300 million into their campaign to defeat reform. While Washington was caught up in health care reform and Whitewater, the rest of the world was not. In early May, the UN tightened sanctions on the military junta in Haiti, and a new wave of Haitian refugees headed to American shores. A crisis was building, and Bill felt he had to ask Al Gore to fill in for him on a trip to South Africa for Nelson Mandela's presidential inauguration. Tipper and I joined Al as members of the U.S. delegation. We landed on the outskirts of Johannesburg, a sprawling modern city in South Africa's dry central highlands. That night, we attended a performance at the famous Market Theater, where for years, Atoll Fugard and other playwrights had defied government censors and depicted the agony of apartheid. Afterwards, we were treated to a buffet dinner featuring assorted African specialties, along with the usual carved meats and salads. I wasn't as adventurous as Maggie and the rest of my staff, who dared one another to sample the fried grasshoppers and grubs. Our delegation drove north to the capital, Pretoria. 50,000 people attended the inauguration, a spectacle of celebration, release, and vindication. Mandela's speech denounced discrimination on the basis of race and gender, two profoundly embedded prejudices in Africa and most of the rest of the world. As we were leaving the ceremony, I saw the Reverend Jesse Jackson weeping with joy. He leaned over and said to me, "Did you ever think any of us would live to see this day?" We returned by motorcade to the president's residence to find it transformed. The long, winding drive through green lawns was arrayed with brightly costumed drummers and dancers from throughout South Africa. One of my challenges that afternoon was Fidel Castro. The State Department briefers had warned me that Castro wanted to meet me. They told me to avoid him at all costs, since we had no diplomatic relations with Cuba, not to mention a trade embargo. "You can't shake hands with them," they told me. "You can't talk to him." Even if I accidentally bumped into him, the anti-Castro factions in Florida would go wild. I frequently looked over my shoulder during the reception, watching for his bushy gray beard in the crowd of faces. It was ridiculous, but I knew that a single photograph, stray sentence, or chance encounter could become news. Lunch was served on the grounds under an enormous white canvas tent. Mandela rose to address his guests. He made the expected remarks to welcome us. Then he said something that left me in awe. While he was pleased to host so many dignitaries, he was most pleased to have in attendance three of his former jailers from Robben Island, who had treated him with respect during his long imprisonment. He asked them to stand so he could introduce them to the crowd. His generosity of spirit was inspiring and humbling. For months, I had been preoccupied with the hostility in Washington and the mean-spirited attacks connected to Whitewater, Vince Foster, and the Travel Office. But here was Mandela, honoring three men who had held him prisoner. When I got to know Mandela better, he explained that the day his imprisonment ended, as I walked out the door toward the gate that would lead to my freedom, I knew if I didn't leave my bitterness and hatred behind, I'd still be in prison. Still pondering Mandela's example the night I returned from South Africa, I joined five former First Ladies at the National Garden Gala. I was the honorary chair of the event at the U.S. Botanic Garden to help raise funds to construct a new garden that would be a living landmark on the Mall, dedicated to eight contemporary First Ladies and honoring our contributions to the nation. I was delighted that Lady Bird Johnson was able to attend. The photos from that gala evening were keepers. Lady Bird, Barbara Bush, Nancy Reagan, Rosalind Carter, Betty Ford, and me. It was quite a sight. All the living First Ladies standing together on stage, except for one. Some months earlier, Jackie had been diagnosed with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, an often deadly but sometimes slow-moving cancer. As a result, she was unable to be with us. True to character, she tried to keep her dying as private as she'd kept her life. On May 19, 1994, Jackie Kennedy Onassis died in her New York apartment, with Caroline, John, and Maurice at her side. Early the following morning, Bill and I went to the Jacqueline Kennedy Garden off the east colonnade of the White House to share our thoughts with a gathering of press, staff, and friends. Bill recognized her contributions to our country, while I talked about her selfless devotion to her children and grandchildren. She once explained the importance of spending time with family and said, "If you bungle raising your children, I don't think whatever else you do matters very much." I could not have agreed more. I attended her funeral mass in New York City at St. Ignatius Loyola Roman Catholic Church, and then flew to Washington with her family and close friends. Bill met the plane at the airport and went with us to the grave where Jackie was buried beside President John F. Kennedy. 2 weeks later, John F. Kennedy Jr. sent Bill and me a handwritten letter that I cherish. He wrote, "I wanted you both to understand how much your burgeoning friendship with my mother meant to her. Since she left Washington, I believe she resisted ever connecting with it emotionally, or the institutional demands of being a former First Lady. It had much to do with the memories stirred and her desires to resist being cast in a lifelong role that didn't quite fit. However, she seemed profoundly happy and relieved to allow herself to reconnect with it through you. It helped her in a profound way, whether it was discussing the perils of raising children in those circumstances, perilous indeed, or perhaps it was the many similarities between your presidency and my father's. In early June 1994, Bill and I traveled to England for the commemoration of the 50th anniversary of the Normandy invasion that set in motion the end of World War II in Europe. Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II had invited us to spend the night on the royal yacht, HMS Britannia, and I was excited by the prospect of getting to know the royal family. At the grand dinner, I sat between Prince Philip and Prime Minister John Major at a head table long enough to accommodate all the kings, queens, prime ministers, and presidents in attendance. Prince Philip, a polished conversationalist, carefully divided his time between me and the woman on his other side, the Queen of Belgium. Queen Elizabeth, seated next to Bill, wore a sparkling diamond tiara that caught the light as she nodded and laughed at Bill's stories. She reminded me of my own mother in appearance, politeness, and reserve. The morning after, I met Princess Diana for the first time at the drumhead service, a traditional religious ceremony that commemorates the point at which troops cannot be pulled back from battle. Diana was estranged, though not yet divorced, from Prince Charles. She attended the ceremony alone. I watched as she greeted the crowd of supporters who clearly doted on her. Uncommonly beautiful, she used her eyes to draw people in, dropping her head forward to greet you while lifting her eyes upward. She radiated life and a sense of vulnerability that I found heartbreaking. Although there was little time to talk during this visit, I came to know and like her. Diana was a woman torn between competing needs and interests, but she genuinely wanted to make a contribution, to have her life count for something. She became an effective advocate for AIDS awareness and landmine eradication. She was also a devoted mother, and whenever we met, we discussed the challenge of raising children in the public spotlight. Although I had read Stephen Ambrose's book D-Day, I was not prepared for the height of the cliffs that had to be scaled by Allied forces after they fought their way across the beaches on June 6, 1944. They looked impenetrable, and I listened with reverence to the veterans who had made that climb. Bill's relationship with the military had gotten off to a rocky start, so a lot was riding on his speech about D-Day. Like me, he had opposed the Vietnam War, believing that it was misconceived and unwinnable. As the first modern president to have come of age during Vietnam, Bill carried with him into the White House the unresolved feelings of our country about that war, and he believed it was time to reconcile our differences as Americans and begin a new chapter of cooperation with our former enemy. With the support of many Vietnam veterans serving in Congress, Bill lifted a U.S. trade embargo on Vietnam in 1994. A year later, he normalized diplomatic relations between our countries, and in 2000, Bill would become the first American president to set foot on Vietnamese soil since U.S. troops left in 1975. Bill addressed the American veterans of our parents' generation in the speech he delivered at the World War II Normandy American Cemetery. "We are the children of your sacrifice," he said. His D-Day speech was particularly emotional for him, because he had recently received a copy of his father's military record and the history of his unit, which participated in the invasion of Italy. Following the story of his father's service in several newspapers, Bill received a letter from a man living in New Jersey who had immigrated from Italy. As a young boy, he had been befriended by an American soldier who served in the motor pool of the invading army. The soldier who had taught the youngster how to fix cars and trucks was Bill's father, William Blythe. Bill was thrilled to hear about his father and felt that he was connecting with that young soldier and the father he never knew as he tried to express our generation's gratitude for all that he and millions of others had done for our nation and the world. That trip had been emotional for me as well. I wanted Bill's presidency to succeed, not simply because he was my husband and I loved him, but because I loved my country and believed he was the right man to lead it at the end of the 20th century. Aretha Franklin rocked the Rose Garden one unforgettable night in June as part of the in-performance concert series that we held at the White House. She leaned in close to Bill, who swayed in his seat, as she sang, "Smile, what's the use of crying?" 10 days later, Robert Fisk released the preliminary finding in his fast-moving Whitewater investigation. First, no one in the Clinton White House or Department of the Treasury had tried to influence the inquiry by the Resolution Trust Corporation, the federal agency that examined McDougal's failed savings and loan, Madison Guaranty. Second, Fisk concurred with the opinions of the FBI and Park Police that Vince Foster's death was a suicide. He further concluded that there was no evidence his suicide had anything to do with Whitewater. Ironically, on the day Fisk's findings were made public, my husband inadvertently paved the way for his replacement by signing the renewal of the Independent Counsel Act sent to him by Congress. It was something he had promised to do, and he kept his word. Because of the growing Republican criticism of Fisk, I had argued against signing the legislation unless the appointment of Fisk was grandfathered into the bill. I shared my fears with Lloyd Cutler, who had replaced Bernie Nussbaum as White House counsel. Lloyd, a true gentleman, assumed he was dealing with men of similar manners and even told me he would, quote, eat his hat if Fisk was replaced. According to the newly enacted law, the independent counsel had to be chosen by a special division. A panel of three federal judges appointed by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, William Rehnquist. Rehnquist had handpicked David Sentell, an ultra-conservative Republican from North Carolina, to head the special division. On August 5th, the special division announced the appointment of a new independent counsel. Robert Fisk was out, replaced by Kenneth Starr. Starr was a 48-year-old Republican insider, a former appeals court judge who had stepped down to become Solicitor General in the first Bush administration, a traditional path to the Supreme Court. He was a partner in Kirkland & Ellis, a law firm with a lucrative business defending tobacco companies. Starr was a staunch conservative. Unlike Fisk, he had never been a prosecutor. He had been outspoken about the Paula Jones lawsuit, appearing on TV that spring to argue for the right of Jones to sue a sitting president, urging that the case proceed quickly. Starr's appointment greatly slowed the progress of the investigation. Most of Fisk's staff resigned rather than work for him. Fisk had intended to wrap up the investigation by the end of 1994. It appeared Starr's goal from the beginning was to keep the issue alive at least through the 1996 election. Given these troubling conflicts of interest and early warning signs, it was clear that Starr was replacing Fisk not to continue an independent investigation, but for partisan purposes. All spring and summer, right-wing radio hosts with national audiences stirred up their listeners with terrifying tales from Washington. Rush Limbaugh routinely told his 20 million radio listeners that Whitewater is about health care. And I finally understood that, yes, it was. The ongoing Whitewater investigation, despite Fisk's findings, was about undermining the progressive agenda by any means. After 20 months, we conceded defeat of our plan for health care reform. We knew we had alienated a wide assortment of health care industry experts and professionals, as well as some of our own legislative allies. Ultimately, we could never convince the vast majority of Americans who have health insurance that they wouldn't have to give up benefits and medical choices to help the minority of Americans without coverage. Bill and I were disappointed and discouraged. I knew I had contributed to our failure, both because of my own missteps and because I underestimated the resistance I would meet as a First Lady with a policy mission. But our most critical mistake was trying to do too much too fast. That said, I still believe we were right to try. Our work in 1993 and 94 paved the way for what several economists dubbed the Hillary factor, the purposeful restraint on price increases by medical providers and pharmaceutical companies during the 1990s. It also helped to create the ideas and political will that led to important smaller reforms in the years following. The nation now has a law guaranteeing that workers will not lose their insurance when they change jobs. I worked behind the scenes with Senator Kennedy to help create the Children's Health Insurance Program called CHIP, which by 2003 provided coverage to more than 5 million children of working parents too well off for Medicaid but unable to afford private insurance. Bill signed a series of bills that I had worked for, including ensuring that women be allowed to stay for more than 24 hours after childbirth in the hospital, promoting